Good afternoon and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, community radio from Viroqua, Wisconsin, in the Driftless area, which is the southwestern corner of Wisconsin. And you can also listen on the internet by going to our website, wdrt.org. And you'll be listening right now, or you can go back and listen to previous shows, or if you like this one and you want to hear the whole thing, you can go back to wdrt.org and listen again and at any time that you want to. In the studio with me today is my wonderful engineer, Jim Hallberg. He's still around, although he's not doing his show so much. Are you still doing a bit of your morning show?
Yes. 2 days a week.
Yeah, but he's my pal and copain. And my guest today is Gene Ruffin from rural Reedstown, I guess, in Wisconsin. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Philippia. Thanks
for joining me. I wanted to do a show about the harvest from the garden, and we just had our first really killing frost last night, so We're all breathing kind of a sigh of relief. I'm sure there's gardeners out there that know what we mean. Just all the toiling that goes on and the harvesting, and then, whew, it's gone. So did you have a hard frost?
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And you know what I covered? I covered my marigolds.
Still have color.
They will, and you know, I found out that you can get a big frost, and if you cover the marigolds and then it warms up again, which it's going to do for the next couple of weeks, then you still have some color in the garden. And I have those wonderful tiny Mexican marigolds, just little billions of little tiny marigolds, and they're so sweet. So I love those. So, and then I save the seeds, of course. So, I just wanted to give you a little background on Jean, and I'll let her tell you too, but she moved out here a couple of years ago. I'm not sure how many years ago.
Five.
So, but I recently met Jean, and we've become friends, and she really embarked on a whole new lifestyle coming from Chicago suburbs and coming out to southwestern Wisconsin to do some farming and shepherding. So tell us how you got here, Jean.
Well, as I saw retirement approaching, I'm like, what do I do with myself? And I realized I like to garden, so I started looking into different gardening classes, and then my brother, who lives up near Lafarge, was into permaculture. So I started looking into that, and I found out I could take some classes nearby in Naperville at a place called the Resiliency Institute, and they were doing suburban permaculture. So basically, I turned my yard into a permaculture mini paradise because it was very small, 60 by 80 lot, and I had fruit trees and all kinds of edible landscaping and native plants, and I made a little swale. My grandsons helped me dig it, and it took all the rainwater from my roof on the front part of my house and watered my lawn, so I never had to water the lawn. So that was the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. And then as I began to realize I actually could buy land up here, I started looking, and that was at my brother's encouragement, because he had bought a nice property up near Lafarge and was developing it. And so I looked for about a year and a half, and then I found this property, and I bought it,
and
I built
it. It was really empty.
It was empty. Yeah. It was at the top of almost the top of a ridge, and it was pretty much eroded and just growing a bunch of parsnip and what's the other plant?
Thistle.
Queen Anne's lace. Yeah, Queen Anne's lace. It was really pretty for a while with all the Queen Anne's lace blooming, but it really didn't have much value. And once I had moved in there, one of the farmhands from a nearby farm stopped by and he said, "What are you going to grow on that pile of rocks?" And so I had already been looking into it, and I took a permaculture design course up here that was on Macedon Valley Farm. Peter Allen, that's his farm, and it was a 9-day course, and we learned all about broadacre permaculture. And so I put some of those things to work. My property's only 10 acres, so it's not going to be suburban permaculture, and it's certainly not very broad of an acreage. But
what are you going to do with that pile of rocks?
I know, right. Right, really, because it's eroded, and even the I used to hire, before I got my own little tractor, I used to hire a local man, David Mittem, and he would cut for me, you know, brush hog it. And he was, you know, concerned about the rocks hurting his equipment. And actually, every spring, there's new rocks to pick up and make little edges along things. So I'm working on that constantly. So anyway, that's how I got here.
That is amazing. You know, I just really want to segue right away over to permaculture. I guess I just didn't really realize how much, you know, background you had in permaculture. I mean, you really studied it and you went to courses and so forth. Can you put into fairly a short description of what permaculture actually means and why it would really apply to a piece of land like yours? How does it improve the land?
Oh, so, okay. Well, permaculture is two words, permanent agriculture. So generally, it's using perennial plants planted on a variety of levels and you learn how to, which plants work together and how they work together, and you're using that to develop, to renew. You know, it's not just a matter of putting inputs in and cutting and using. It's a matter of continuing the natural processes that are at work.
So it's probably regenerative.
It's regenerative.
Yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's what it's about. And it's many times using indigenous culture methods, because this is how they were traveling around, and they'd come back and there'd still be a big area of leeks to harvest, which is something, you know, European style farming necessarily is not going to leave. Like Chicago it refers to a certain type of onion, which doesn't even grow there anymore because it was so harvested. And I think it's the wild leeks. You know, I think I've read that before. So anyway, what was the question?
Oh, it was... yeah, we can't
get off on a tangent.
Permaculture. Yeah. Oh, how does it help the land then?
Well, I mean, you're building soil. You're growing the little organisms at the most basic level. You're encouraging the growth of these organisms that are constantly there, that break down the waste materials and create more humus. And interestingly, humus and human have the same basic root, which means earth. So, I mean, basically, if you get involved in doing these things, it's very grounding, because it's what we are.
Ah.
You know, well, so.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Permaculture takes those things into account.
Well, it's as you say, it's more permanent plantings, and our agriculture pretty much now is annual inputs. Mm-hmm. And so you just plow up the ground, and then you maybe put all kinds of additives on, and then you put in a seed, and then you harvest it, and then you have bare ground again, and so you have the challenges of the bare ground, you have the challenges of all the weeds, you have a monocrop, which I think in permaculture you're really blending different crops, you know, so they just don't, already you avoid some of the problems that you have with just an annual monoculture. And some, you know, we used to rotate crops, but it seems like recently people grow the same thing over and over again on the same land, and then they wonder why they have pests and why the soil has become depleted. And then you have to go put, you know, additives to the soil, and then that's where the chemical farming comes in. So I'm sure permaculture is really a way of avoiding putting unnatural things and processes into
the
soil.
Simple things, which is where the sheep come in, because you know, those little microorganisms very often are found in the in the intestines of ruminants, which is what used to wander. That's why Peter's farm is called Mastodon Valley Farm, because that was the original ruminant, the mastodons wandering around, dropping their deposits, eating from the trees, you know. And so it's just this harmonious culture of animals and plants mm-hmm. that perpetuates itself.
Wow. So tell me what kind of animals you've had.
Well, I've just had sheep because, I've only been here for the 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of sheep did you get?
I got Shetland sheep.
And aren't they miniatures or something? Or,
they're just easy small? And they're smaller. And I was thinking, I'm getting older, I don't want to try to, for sure cows are too big for me, but sheep are easy to manage comparatively. Mm-hmm. And even though if they get out, I can't run and catch them, I can do things to keep them in and keep them safe that I won't, once it's done, like a permanent fence around their whole area, that will eliminate that problem.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I close gates.
Well, fencing has been a challenge.
Yeah,
to get that fencing done. I mean, I'm having to face that too. We haven't done much with our permanent fence. We're working on one side at a time, one boundary at a time. But if you want to have livestock, you've got to be able to keep them in.
Yeah.
And keep them protected,
too. Yeah, because the grass is always greener.
It's really something. Well, now, for the sheep, do you use them for wool or meat, or are you just using them as just part of your permaculture pattern or rhythm?
Well, yes. Shetlands have beautiful fleece, and it comes in a variety of colors. It's very interesting. They have names for all those colors. I wouldn't say I know them at all, but maybe someday. But anyway, they have nice fleece. They have delicious meat. I have harvested some rams. I have bred them once. I'm going to breed them again this December. I've got a little ram whose name is Crumpet, who's coming to visit for a month. And hopefully he'll do the deed, and I'll have lambs coming out of my ears. I'll probably say after that, I'll never do that again, but we'll see. And then I eat the rams or sell them if maybe somebody would be interested in a couple of sheep for their kids or something.
Oh,
you
I would
be. Okay,
would
cool.
Be.
They're
I'll
really
take
nice.
Some off your hands.
They're nice animals.
Oh, I remember raising one little lamb that was, his mom wasn't taking care of him, so we took him on and feeding him with a bottle and everything. I even took him to work and kept him on my lap while I was typing, and nobody even knew he was. I just slept for hours on my lap.
Sweet.
Honestly, they're so fun. And sheep, you have a small enough flock, so
yeah.
You probably have nice contact with them.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes sheep just are kind of distant. They don't really want to have anything to do with the people. But when you just have a few, and especially if you raised them on bottles, they're really like pets.
Oh, even if they're not raised on bottles, I go out every day, and at the beginning they were skittish and shy of me. But I would go. I took my 5 gallon little plastic bucket and turn it upside down and sit out there with them, and then they come around and they try to eat your clothes and they nuzzle you, and pretty soon they get used to you. And especially if you rotationally graze them, because then every time they see you, you are moving them into a good place. And so they come running up, and they do, after a while, they also like, a scritchy scratch. You scratch them on their neck and scratch them in their on their backs, and they like that. So they come up just like another animal, a pet, for a scratch.
Well, now, how do you do the rotational grazing? That means you have electric fencing you move?
I have electric fencing, and I move it around inside the perimeter fence.
And what do you do for water?
If they're close enough to the barn, I have a permanent waterer there, and it's a heated waterer, so I can. In fact, I got to start thinking about turning that on, so
it won't freeze.
Yeah, so it won't freeze. So otherwise, I have a.
Do you have to carry water?
Well, I have a galvanized bucket. I think it's about an 8 gallon bucket, and sheep. They tell you that you should supply them with half a gallon each a day, but sheep do not do that. They don't drink that much. They get quite a bit of moisture from the plants they're eating, but they will come up and drink. So I have a zero-turn mower, and I fill a 5-gallon bucket with water when they're too far from the barn, and I put it between my legs on the zero-turn mower and drive it out there. Mm-hmm. I was, the first year I had the sheep, I was trying to pull it out in a wagon, and that gets tiring fast. So anyway, this is better, especially as I'm getting older. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah, and then pour that in to the bucket.
Trough or whatever.
To the trough, mm-hmm. Yeah, the galvanized thingy, and, mm-hmm. and then they come and drink from that, and I check it every other day and add more if necessary.
Now, what are some of the basic pieces of equipment that you have on your little 10-acre place? You have a zero-turn mower, and mm-hmm. But you don't even have a little wagon to pull behind that mower.
No, it doesn't have a hitch.
That is kind of nice, because sometimes you just want a little bit, like you say, instead of carrying a bucket between your legs, being able to put a little...
When I first got there, I bought a used, from my neighbor, a used tractor, a lawn tractor, but it was pretty old, and I could barely get up some of the slopes in it. So then I was able to buy this thing, and it's really not made for, I could not use it to cut the field, because it's really made for golf course type lawns, and our fields here are bumpy. There's old furrows, there's gopher hills, there's ant hills. It's just really hard.
So you still have somebody who comes and mows if you need to
No,
have it mowed?
No, because this year,
it's cheaper keeping it down.
I bought a tractor.
Oh, okay.
I bought a little tractor over at Richland Center's, what's it called? I can't think of the name of it right now, but it's a tractor store there. Right on 14.
Mm-hmm. What size tractor did you get? You know,
it's 25 horsepower, uh-huh. and I've used it for brush hogging my property, and actually it's really kind of fun. I'm totally into it, and I've also used it to clean out my old sheep bedding from last year. And
you have a digger? How do you do that?
I have it's got a bucket.
A bucket.
And it's the tractor, the bucket, and I had him take off the deck mower because I have that zero turn mower, and instead I got the brush hog. And so those are the three pieces. And mm-hmm. I probably, if I really wanted to make cleaning out sheep bedding easier, I should get a grapple. But at this rate, it's just a matter of you pull the tractor up with the bucket and use your pitchfork and load in sheep bedding, get a whole big bucket full and go dump it. And I couldn't do that without that bucket. Mm-hmm. It would just take me all year, mm-hmm.
So what do you do with that? Do you compost it, or
it's in a big pile. Uh-huh. It's going to compost. And then what I did last year with it, when I had help with that from my neighbors, which is another wonderful thing about this area, is neighbors are wonderful. You get this kind of reciprocal relationship where you can help. These neighbors, I haven't been able to really help them except share some of my produce with them. But people are willing to help you out in a pinch.
Or loan you
equipment. Yeah, just very kind.
Very kind. It is really nice.
Yeah.
Well, you're getting to be someone who could be a resource for other people. I mean, you just, not that you're an expert, but you're learning by doing, and then you add up this experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can say, well, I tried this and I tried that, and this is what works for me, and so forth.
Well, that's the thing, too, about permaculture. Every single piece of property is different.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find out, what is my piece of property? Where does the sun shine? Where does the rain fall? And how does it travel down? Where are the game trails? How do animals move across my property? All those kind of things. How does the wind, where's the prevailing winds? Where do they come from? All that stuff makes a big difference in where you plant things and, what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And you have to do this over years.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it takes you a whole year to go through a year.
Yeah, absolutely. And it changes. Yeah. We had droughts these last, now we're kind of in a drought.
Right.
Last year was really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, every year's different.
Yeah. I'm talking with Jean Ruffin, and we started out by talking about permaculture, which she is practicing on her 10-acre piece of land. It's not exactly a farm, but it's bigger Mm-mm. than a yard.
Right.
And it's, you know, that's kind of the type of properties that are available here that people like to buy something that's not 100 or 200 acres. And find out that you really don't need more than 10 acres. Really, that's plenty of work, right?
Oh, yeah.
So Jean is my guest on WDRT today, who's in the kitchen. And I'm Philothea Beeson. I'm your host. And you're listening to 91.9 FM. And it's streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. And we also have podcasts. So I have a feeling you might want to re-listen to this one. Jean has already given us a lot of good information. And so you can go to our archives for Who's in the Kitchen and listen to Jean. You can see why my show has been evolving over to a farming show. I mean, to me, it's all connected, your food and where it comes from. And so you could have been on my farming show, Jean. It's just really interesting. Because I want my listeners to have a chance to see where does our food come from? Why do we care? And even to the point of why do we care what's in the farm bill? Why do we care about what do these farm organizations do out here? And should you join one even if you're not a farmer? I'm beginning to realize it might be a good idea to join the Farmers Union and go to their meetings and read some of their material. Read their magazine when it comes out and things like that, because this is local, and these local people then also have a connection with what's going on statewide and nationwide and how our money is spent at the federal level, you know, all the different grants and programs that people can take advantage of in farming. So people who shop at the grocery store, yeah, I think a lot of people are starting to be interested more where the food is coming from, how the land is being taken care of. Can farmers still afford to do this and remain in farming, or do you have to get big to farm and to manage? But it seems like this kind of farming is really suited to small farmers, mm-hmm. small pieces of land, this permaculture and regenerative farming. So we're going to talk more about Jean's garden. And then she brought some recipe books, and we're going to talk about, preserving some food from the garden and things that you've learned from the garden. Now you've had a garden there 3 or 4 years,
mm-hmm.
and learning what you're going to grow and what you're not going to grow, and are you going to save seeds and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to move on to that. I see that your garden is a little distance away from the house. Mine is right just at my back door. And I just love having it so close by. I used to have a larger garden. It used to be further away. But tell me about the placement of your garden and the fencing and all that had to go into that.
Well, actually, I feel like it's close to my house.
Good. Well, so, it's really.
You
can see it and you can mm-hmm. walk to it.
Mm-hmm. When you plan something in permaculture, there's this zone thing. So zone one is where you live and where you would put your garden and the things that you're going to walk the least to. So mm-hmm. I did include that in zone one, what I would consider zone one. It's really only, it's just down the hill, but that's the other thing. It's very sloped, so, you know, I didn't want to put it right next to the house, also because of the shadow of the house,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it misses all that. It gets sun all day long.
Yeah.
But anyway, before I planted the garden, I found a fence man, and he put up I hadn't lived here yet, so I was trying to mitigate any possibility of deer eating up my whole garden. Mm-hmm. So I had him put deer fencing, which is like 8-foot fencing. So it's ridiculous. You know, nobody, I look around and I don't really see anybody with 8-foot fences around their gardens, but I have that.
Is it anchor fencing or what is it?
It's kind of like orchard fencing. They're like a foot by maybe 6 inch. The deer would have to jump over it. And I know some deer probably can jump 8 feet high, but it's too small.
They wouldn't land
in the middle. They'd run into the other fence, probably.
But the fence keeps you, as my neighbors just put one in, too, it keeps you from tilling with a large machine.
Well, that's true.
And do you till it anymore? Or do you,
I try not to till mm-hmm. it. You know, you have to till it. You should double
you
dig
break
it to get,
yeah. Sod.
And this is all, I have real clay soil up there, very hard. But it's got all the nutrients in it, so you just have to amend it. And so I did run a rototiller the first year and rototilled. I have three beds, and then all along the fence, there's a bed.
So you can get the tiller in there.
Yeah, it's just, I just like a cultivator,
yeah.
a little hand
a little,
one.
Yeah.
Just go, it's not, my garden isn't that big.
Mm.
And people don't think it's a big garden. It's 29 by 24.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget why I came up with those. That's a pretty strange dimensions. But anyway, that's what it is. And so I plant, I have the three beds that are like 4 feet by, I think, 21. And then, you know, around the edges.
And you have paths between them.
And paths. Paths that are big enough to push a wheelbarrow through.
Is it just sod, or what are the paths?
Well, first I tried just having grass, but then you have to get around and mow that constantly in the busy time of the summer, so I thought, I'm not doing that. So I put cardboard down and sheet mulched it and went over to a Amish sawmill and got a bunch of hardwood chips and put that down, and that keeps it down, but that eventually breaks down, and then you're still getting from the grass on the outside, lots of grass coming in. So it's a constant battle, and I will have to do that sheet mulching again and just put a bunch of nice, and which is like a wonderful thing to me that I can get a cubic yard of wood chips for $12. I mean, that would have cost me $150 in the suburbs, you know, so it's great.
Yeah, we're producing a lot of that in the various mills and mm-hmm. yeah. And
yeah.
Even the towns have a lot of wood chips and things like that that they get. So what were your beds made out of? Did you actually have beds built out of wood?
No,
I
just dig them up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be really nice to have raised beds, but I'd have to figure out the slope and figure out each bed would be a little different. I'm not a carpenter, so then I'd have to hire somebody. So maybe someday I will.
Mm-hmm. So they're just dug into the soil.
They're just
kind of mounded up. And you really keep those weeded.
Yeah, and I use the sheep bedding to amend it. When I had chickens, I used chicken bedding to amend it. And,
mm-hmm.
I'll put some in this fall. And actually, it's just laying on top. I use a broad fork
mm-hmm.
in the spring to break things up.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of breaking it up, but you're not turning it over and breaking all the little networks of hopefully mycelium and
mm-hmm.
stuff that are growing in there.
Say, Jean, I might like to borrow your broad fork.
You could.
We just dug up a couple of beds to put the garlic in,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, it's just like flower pots. I mean, the soil is so hard and clay, and it's
yeah.
just in chunks. Will a broad fork break
oh,
that
yeah.
up?
Oh, yeah, and I got the... I can't remember the company I bought it from, but they had ones for tough soil, and I bought one of those. It's thick. It's about a quarter of an inch thick
tines?
Steel.
Yeah.
Yeah, the tines. And there, I think there are five tines.
Mm-hmm.
It's good exercise.
You really stand on it.
Yeah, you stand on it, kind
it
of rock,
uh-huh.
and then you break it,
uh-huh.
and then you move up to the next section. And
wow.
It's fun.
So you got your beds dug, and what did you decide to put in as your crops?
Well, nightshades, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant. What else? Beans. I found that green beans, which always my whole life I really liked them until now. I they're okay, but I like dried beans. So I grow more dried beans, and those are great because they're so simple. You just put them in, let them grow, and wait till they're all dried up, and then you take them. You don't have to do any running
mm-hmm.
out and checking if there's
mm-hmm.
if they're ready or not.
So what varieties have you enjoyed using?
I really like Crimson Runner. They make a really nice big bean, but they don't grow so well on my. I think I'll give them one more year and see if I can figure out what I'm doing wrong or what they need. And if I can't figure that out, then that's the end of them. But I like Tiger Eye. I found that, which is a really nice little bean, pretty. I've grown Good Mother Stollards and Turkey Craw. And
do they need any kind of staking or?
Ones are long vining beans, uh-huh. And I like those better than the bush ones because if it gets wet, and you don't get out there, you know, they'll start sprouting right in their pods.
Oh,
you know, toward the end
mm-hmm.
of the season,
and they could get moldy too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So. So I'm just growing the vining ones.
So how do you support them though?
Say that again.
How do you support the vines? Do you put
Have cattle panels.
Cattle panels. Okay.
Yeah, and I just bend them over and attach them to T posts, and it just makes a great permanent arch. You know,
okay.
Durable and mm-hmm. nothing's too heavy for it. I have tried growing squash on it, but it didn't work out too well for me. Cucumbers. This year wasn't good for cucumbers. You know, that was okay. The best has been beans so far.
Mm-hmm. But then you said you did the Three Sisters, so what did you put
yeah.
in?
Yeah, so that's what I did this year.
Okay.
I made another section next to this garden that is, it's kind of roughly triangular just because of the way my pasture fence goes and the way the garden itself goes. I did it so that it would be easy to mow around.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's that shape. It's 24 on one side, 25 on another, 8 on another, and I don't even know what the back side is.
This is in addition to the garden that's
yes.
in the deer fencing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I grew popcorn. That's another thing. Corn, I don't know that it agrees with me, but it's nice to have snack food, so I thought I'll grow popcorn. So I looked up Three Sisters Gardens, and I saw that there's a method called that the Hidatsa Indians used, who are Northern Plain, I think.
Could
Indians.
You say that word again?
I think it's Hidatsa.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it is. I should have looked that up again. But at any rate, you make 18-inch mounds, and you plant corn about 6 inches apart at the top of the mound. When that's about 6 inches high, you plant your beans around that, and then the beans will grow up as the corn stalks grow. And these little, and they will help to support the corn, and they will also, they have a trellis to climb on. So that's where I grew my Tiger Eye beans. And Tiger Eye beans are technically bush beans, but they grow 4 to 5 feet tall.
Okay.
So, you know, they need a trellis.
Yeah.
So that was kind of perfect. And the corn was supposed to only get like 5 feet tall, according to the packet. It's a calico corn. It's like 8 feet tall. It's huge.
Mm.
And so I could have grown my Crimson Runners on that, but I didn't. So in between that, then you make mounds for your squash. And I have grown this year Delicata, which is my favorite, and Butter Baby, and Spaghetti, and I grew Acorn, but I started them late because the seeds I had were left over. I think they were a little old and they didn't sprout, so then I had to put them in again. So I won't have much. I think I have one very mm-hmm. tiny acorn squash, which I don't even know if is ripe enough to eat or not. And after today, there's definitely no more squash coming. So I have not a real great squash output, so I need to work on the soil in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it just needs more amending.
I was going to say, it just probably needs a lot of nutrients from your manure, which you're going to have. You're going to have plenty
right.
of manure. So then, within your garden again.
Well, also, I have to mention, it's really a Four Sisters garden because it has sunflowers. So I grew Mongolian Giants on the back side, which is the north side, and then I grew Velvet Queen on the front side. And the Mongolian Giants have like 12 to 14 inch, maybe even bigger heads. So I've harvested, you know, there were only 8 of them, But how, I mean, it's a lot of sunflower seeds. And I've left one for the critters, and I've left all the velvet queen, because they're not really edible, and the birds are loving that.
Mm-hmm.
And also you have pretty sunflowers to bring into the house.
Don't they fall down?
Yes, they do. Yeah, and also, we had a big wind earlier this year, and it knocked all the corn and everything down. So I was able to pull it back up, and I staked it to a mm-hmm. bunch of T-posts, and that's kept up, you know, until now.
Oh, okay. Because I remember growing some mammoth, Russian mammoth or something like that. They really were fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, photogenic. But they did, you know, I was disappointed. They get so heavy that they just get top heavy and they want to fall
down. Oh, they bend
down.
Over their heads too, but that's also a strategy for planting themselves again. Just kind of awesome just to
right.
see what the
so
plants
do. So
you're going
to use those seeds for bird feed?
No, I'm going to eat those seeds.
You are?
I'm going to have to, I mean, a certain amount of them anyway. We'll see.
How do you harvest them, I mean, in quantity?
Well, you cut the head off and uh-huh. then you hang it up and let it dry. It's in my garage right now, or they are in my garage right now, hanging up, and then you have to shell them. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's I'm looking into some kind of method other than me biting them.
I was
them.
Wondering if there's you're biting if there was some kind of little hand mechanism that
I've seen or? One on the internet, but I'm not a mechanic, so I won't be able to put that together. There are these little ones that you could put four seeds in. At a time, but that's better than one at a time. And they're not very expensive. Mm-hmm. And then there are the big, huge industrial ones, which are, you know, I don't need
thousands
that.
Yeah.
But I also saw a method where somebody took a paddle attachment to their mixer and they put a bunch of the dry seeds in and they just turned the mixer on and it broke the shells. And then you dump that out on the table and you just pick out the kernels.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a mess mm-hmm. no matter what. It's just like shelling nuts, you know. It's always taken more time than you'd like.
Well, let's see. What did I harvest? I think it might have been coriander seeds. Yeah, coriander seeds. And I just sat out with a great big basket, like in, you know, olden days,
uh-huh.
and just flipped them up in the air and let the wind blow the chaff off until I had seeds. I mean, it is, you
that's
could do that with the sunflowers.
Once
you get them kind of broken off, have the shells broken off, maybe.
Although the heaviness of the shells is probably...
Will they float or not?
Oh, they will float. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So that's a great way.
So you could do them with water and then dry the seeds or something.
Okay, thanks.
Well, okay.
Solved.
Oh, this is fun. I mean, you're doing a lot of things that I'm sort of did do.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of pared down my garden this year because I'm getting kind of old and... You know what I found out? I had more tomatoes than I needed. I mean, really, how many tomatoes can one person eat?
Yeah.
And I didn't really have that many fresh tomatoes. I was out of town for the 2 weeks that the big harvest came in, and so now my friends have put them just whole into plastic bags and put them in the freezer. So now I'm going to have, you know, have tomatoes to cook or roast or whatever, mm-hmm. make into soup and so forth. But I think that was 9 plants. I remember one year we did 99.
Oh, boy.
That's when you grow all your own from your seeds, you know, and then you have all these seedlings, and then your husband, you know, rotivates a half acre of land, and you plant all these tomatoes. I don't know what we
ever did. What did you do with them?
I don't know.
Did you sell them?
A lot of them went to waste.
Oh,
a lot of them are just wasted because we just couldn't even harvest them all, and I don't think they grew that well because we had them too close together.
Mm-hmm.
This time I use a cattle paddling for my mm-hmm. for my trellising, and that just works great. And I get a variety, so like I don't even know what I had. I went to Amish greenhouses and got this and that, and then I had some friends that just planted. So I ended up planting 9 plants. There were the, you know, those wonderful orange ones, which again is sun gold.
Little cherry tomatoes.
And then really small ones that are just adorable, like a whole little stalk of little tinies the size of cranberries, really bright red. I don't know what they are. And then I always love Amish paste, mm-hmm. which I dry. That I dehydrate those, and they aren't very juicy, and they're still good to eat fresh. And they're just gigantic. They're like baseballs. They're really amazing. And then I had something like black crim, but I don't know. Again, I bought it, and I'm not keeping very good track. I used to keep journals of what I had planted and the exact, you know, and I didn't do that this year. But they are beautiful tomatoes and delicious, and they're so pretty in a salad because they're black and then this rosy red inside and very juicy. And but they took a long time to ripen, so we kept saying, are they ready? Are they ready? Well, they were really green inside. And it wasn't until they got rosy on the bottom that we knew they were ripening. But they were there quite late. And then I had a wall of tomatoes about the size of a fig. Just a wall. I never saw so many tomatoes in my life. And they are small, with lots of peel on them and lots of seeds. And I thought maybe I wouldn't grow those again, but I don't know how I got them. I guess I thought they were like San Marzanos or something like that, but they were really small. So that was my, but I have such a much smaller garden now. I had a few pepper plants that didn't do very well, too much shade. And I had 5 cauliflower plants, and I've got cauliflower in my freezer from last year, so it's kind of like, I guess I don't need more than 5 cauliflower plants. And then I grew garlic. I love growing garlic, and I love growing onions. And then I just put in some green beans after I harvested my garlic. I put in some nice, slender, French-style, you know, filet beans. And they were just starting to bear, and I went out just a few days ago, and the deer had just mowed them down. So they're like about, there are some still pods on there, and maybe they'll grow. I covered them to protect them from the frost, and maybe they'll have another couple of weeks to grow. But I'm going to have to, you know, I really have to protect them from the deer now. And then I just have herbs and flowers. That's kind of what I've gone to. And I did not have very good luck with lettuce this year for some reason. And then I have neighbors who've just, they have a greenhouse, and they have huge gardens, and they've just said, well, just come over and get what you need. And I like need 3 kale leaves. I mean, I'm really not really consuming a lot each week.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how much I love gardening. I think it's healthy for the soul.
I agree.
And it's such a pleasure to look at. But I am kind of going more toward, you know, herbs and flowers. It's what I call it is a potager. I found that word in a book. It's called a potager, and it's really a soup garden is what it is. Soup and salad garden.
Okay.
That you just run out, oh, I just need a few leaves for this. And it's not so much your big harvest garden where you're going to put up gallons of something. I'm not really doing that anymore. But the potager is part of, it's kind of like what you're talking about, because there's a lot of permanent stuff in there. And I let things go to seed. So then next spring, up comes the dill, and up comes the certain flowers that just reseed themselves, and calendula. And then coriander usually reseeds itself, and then I have mints, which was probably dumb to put them in. Lemon balm is going crazy in there. So then you have really, you're not tilling anymore. You have a mixture, and you're just, you know, just digging a little pot and putting in some seeds, and and so it is, in a way, it's mindless permaculture, I guess. Not very well planned, but
well, you know, what's his name? Mark Shepherd, who was a local person here, who's very famous, and
he gives classes and
he
tours
does, and he uses stun method, which is, I'm not going to say it right. Sheer total utter neglect, I think, is, you know, but he's had really good, I mean, that's the thing, you know, once you figure out what you're going to grow and you get it to grow, then, and it, permanent crops, perennials, then they just keep growing. So, yeah, it's less work in the long run.
Well, I guess so. It doesn't look so mind-boggling. You just go out and you, for somebody getting to be my age, you just go out and you have a little 4x4 bed, and you're just going to put some things in, and then next to that, maybe you'll put in some alyssum, or you'll put in some marigolds or something, you know. And honestly, if you want a pollinator garden, herbs are the thing to grow. I have, oh gosh, I'm going to draw a blank, that wonderful blue flower. Borage. Mm-hmm. Borage. Well, of course, bees love that blue mm-hmm. flower. And I just grow up the flowers. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. use it for anything. Somebody tell me what I can use borage for. But then I had a lot of thyme, which did really well, and rosemary and sage. And the bees are just like buzzing all over. So I can see, you know, herbs have that place in the garden, just not just for culinary, but just mm-hmm. really for pollinating. Mm-hmm. And so my garden kind of looks messy, but you can go out and sort of, you know, deadhead and cut down things that are done and get it under control pretty mm-hmm. quickly.
Yeah. Some of them are so, well, mint. I made the mistake of planting mint the first year, and I'm still pulling that out. And it just takes over every year. Even if you think you got all of it, you didn't. It's still there.
It really has those runners. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, you know, it's kind of like quackgrass. I mean, I used to hate quackgrass, but it really breaks up the soil. Mm. And you see those roots are really, they say it's just like, it's really like a little you know, cultivator.
Huh.
And so you never get rid of the quackgrass either. But if you go at the right times, you can just follow up those runners, and they are really breaking up this clay, which we've really got.
We do.
So the mint pulls up pretty easily. And lemon balm, I've decided lemon balm has just adopted me. I'm not going to get rid of it, so I've just made it into hedges. It's mm-hmm. just hedges in my garden. I harvest so much of it and dry it. And, of course, it's Melissa, and it just is a wonderful tea and very mm-hmm. soothing. And
it's good for, soothing. Yeah. It's good for anxiety.
Yeah wonderful yeah. thing to drink at night. Mm-hmm. So, I guess I'm the kind of gardener that says, well, what will grow, that's what I'm going to grow. Yeah. And if it's hard to grow, I'm not going to struggle with it.
Yeah,
but sometimes if you move something that was really struggling on the west side of your house, you put mm-hmm. it in another location and it does better.
That's true.
So and that always has to come from years of experience. Mm-hmm. Plus I've had years where I've had dozens of cauliflower, and then I try to grow cauliflower the next year and I don't even have any luck with
That's
it. So it's
weird.
Not always like, oh, I'm a great prepper gardener, or I'm a great, you know, green bean gardener. I mean, some years are good and some years aren't, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
So, but anyway, we haven't even covered what you finished and what you did in your garden. So you had tomatoes.
So tomatoes, and I want to mention this one which I grew for the first time, which is called Anya's Dream, and it's an orange and black tomato, and it is absolutely stunning looking, and it's pretty good tasting too. But I wouldn't say it for my taste. I like black creme the best.
Okay.
It's just a nice, sweet tomato.
Yeah.
But anyway, that and green zebra and...
Well, what do you do with your tomatoes? I mean, when you harvest them, what
slice
are you doing?
Slice them, make lots of BLTs, make Greek salad, you know, with tomatoes and uh-huh. cucumbers, red onion.
Do you try to put some by for the winter?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And I have San Marzano. And I also have some speckled Roman. Now, the speckled Roman did okay, but I think it's because I put them along the fence, so they're mm-hmm. kind of right next to where the grass is coming in. So grass always puts everything, you know, stresses everything, makes it work too hard, I guess. Or maybe it steals nutrients or something. But anyway, nothing ever grows as well along the fence as it does in the beds,
uh-huh.
even if I amend them. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I have four San Marzano plants, and I've had tons of tomatoes. I'm also from those, and so I've canned some, I've dried some. I make mm-hmm. the ones that have a spot here and there into salsa, so I've been eating a lot of salsa.
mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah.
You don't try to can salsa, do you?
Pardon me?
Do you can salsa?
I have canned salsa, but... I'm not doing it this year. I am
so
going
nice
to make green tomato
fresh.
Chutney.
Oh.
So that is something I like.
Oh,
and it's a good way to use green tomatoes.
I'd like to get into some recipes before our show is over, which is we're running out of time. You had a recipe for eggplants I really wanted to share. It sounds so exotic.
When my mother was ill, she had a caregiver named Mira. And Mira was Assyrian, A-S-S-Y-R-I-A-N, from Syria, who was here. She's a Christian person from Syria. So she had been here for 20 years. And so she took care of my mom, and she made lots of Middle Eastern food for my mom. And I always liked Middle Eastern food, but I learned some fantastic recipes from her. And this particular one for eggplant is called makdous, and it is baby eggplant, which you barely cook, and then make a hole, either a slit or poke your finger in and push, make a little opening and salt it, press it for 2 days, and let it completely get all the water out. So you've got these little flat baby eggplant, and then you stuff them with a mixture of ground red bell peppers, plus if you want some red hot peppers, so it's red, or you can make a red pepper paste and put that in, garlic minced, and coarsely chopped walnuts. And so that goes into the eggplant, and then you pickle them in olive oil for 2 weeks. So
like
I have some on the shelf right now.
What containers are you putting these in?
I put them in a quart jar.
A quart jar.
I had about enough for a quart jar.
Mm-hmm. They sound beautiful.
Oh, they're
tasty.
They are.
Is there anything else besides the olive oil?
No.
No, just...
You know, you're just careful about the way you... Well, you put them in so that the opening is down, and then you put one layer in, put olive oil over that, and then put the next layer in. You know, just try to eliminate the air pockets. And then, just like with canning, you kind of carefully move them around and release any air that's in there. But they're well salted, so, you know, if you're fermenting things, you're going to make a salt brine.
So
the lactic acid-producing bacteria thrive in that, and the other ones don't. And so then you have, it's evidently the same in olive oil. So this is the first time I've actually had enough baby eggplant to do anything with. So first time I've made this, so we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm.
I can already see some of the mistakes I've made.
So let's go back. Where does the salt come in? Are these two different recipes?
Oh, the salt comes in after you cook the baby eggplant.
Then you salt.
Then you salt them, yeah. And then you weigh them, like put them on a, I found this to be best, put them on a flat, like a baking rack over a pan that can collect all that liquid, and then weigh it down with a brick or something. You're really flattening them out. You're really getting rid of the water. And they're really just like little, you know, less than half an inch, 3/8 of an inch thick.
Oh.
Really flat, okay. Little dried out
eggplant.
So you
start, and then are they, so then they're going to start to ferment?
Then you put, once you put the filling in, once you put them into the olive oil, I mean, maybe they've already started to ferment, but then you're definitely fermenting.
So you'll have some bubbling and stuff.
Yeah,
you'll see that working.
In fact, you have to look, because just like fermenting anything, when something comes to the top and comes out and into the oxygen, you'll get some mold growing on there. So you just remove that. Mm-hmm. So I had one that was they were turning into like little balloons in there, because lactic acid producing bacteria make carbon dioxide, and that's what's coming out of these. It's not oxygen, it's carbon dioxide. And so they're beginning to kind of rise up in the... So you have to keep checking and make sure that the olive oil covers. You might have to pour some more in there. I cheated and weighed it down with a little glass weight that I had. Said not to do that, but I did do that. And so
it
far,
seemed like I needed it.
Yeah. So I took the one out and I ate it, and it definitely wasn't sour yet, but it was still tasty.
So
it's garlicky.
How do you use it? Just as a spread on bread, or
you slice them crosswise, so you see that beautiful, you know, pale green and bright, bright red, and
of the pepper,
and then the little white of the walnuts, you know, studded in there. And you can eat that on pita bread, or I've seen people use it on top of like a red lentil stew. or I don't know. They're just good on a charcuterie board or something. You could put them. Uh-huh. It would be so good.
They sound just fascinating. And can you spell that word again? What was it called?
It's MAKDOUS. Now, you know, of course, this is English rendition of an Arabic word.
Right.
So.
And you got the recipe from this friend, or actually, did you look it up?
She sent me, I looked it up. You can find it. It's very easy to find on the internet. So I found one, and then I sent a picture of my product to Mira. I texted it to her, and she's like, oh, looks great. And then she sent me an Arabic one, where instead of slitting the eggplant, they just poked their finger in and pushed. And I thought that's a much better way because it's making a much less bigger, smaller opening. So things are going to be less apt to fall out.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, anyway, you can find it.
That sounds
great. I'll forward it to you and you can watch it.
Thank you. Well, I've been talking with Jean Ruffin. We haven't hardly covered anything I planned to cover, except that I realized that she was so into permaculture. We spent a lot of time on her garden and how she's been using the land that she bought, just 10 acres outside of Reedstown, and has been, you know, improving the land with the regenerative methods. And she brought a lot of cookbooks, so I think maybe we might have Jean on again, not too far in the future, to talk more about recipes. But thank you so much, Jean, for being on Who's in the Kitchen?
Well, thanks for having me. This was fun. It wasn't nearly as scary as I thought it was going to be.
Good. I'm hoping that, you know, other listeners will realize it's not scary. And if anybody would like to be on the show or knows of somebody that they think should be on Who's in the Kitchen, I'm definitely looking for guests. And be sure to tune in on the last Saturday of the month for Digging Deep, which is a truly farming show here coming from the Driftless area. You've been listening to WDRT 91.9. This has been Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.